Doorbell call here real quick. Okay, so this is with the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for May 25th, 2016. I'll do an initial roll call. Anybody whose name I don't call, please tell us who that you're on the call, so we're clear on who's here. And then Craig will take it from there and finish up the roll call. So far, I have C.F. Soto. I have Mark McCurtich. I have Pat McGuire. I have Dave Schlesinger, Sheila, Frank, John O'Malley, Robin Horton, Craig, Lorenzo and Susan, Cheryl, Sue Serpa, Dick Attlee, Blaine Deeds, Barton Bruce, Ned Delaney, Lynn Bradbury, Paul Zaremka, and Barbara Honegger. Whose name have I not called that's on the teleconference?
You haven't called my name. My name is Kip Beckford.
Okay, can you spell that for me, please?
K-I-P. And the last name is B-E-C-K-F-O-R-D.
Okay. And you're with that? What group are you with, Kip?
Boston 9/11 Truth.
Thank you. Okay. So you want to take it from here?
Yeah, sure. So do you want me to just read that over one more time? Is it, or are we set for the roll call?
Well, I have the feeling that there are some people that we still haven't found that are here yet.
Okay. Somebody mentioned the name Robert, but I don't know if that was Robin Horton or there is a real Robert on the call.
Is there a Robert on the call? This is Robin Horton.
I got 19 on my list.
Yeah, well, I guess we're okay. So if you've got those names, Craig, I guess we can proceed.
The 19 anti-hijackers.
Yet another 19, we could call it, yeah.
Yet another 19.
Okay, so with that...
I have 21.
You're 21.
If it's 21, then I'm missing two.
13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. There are 20 people on the call.
Okay, then I'm missing one name then.
Is that an average of 19 and 21?
Yeah. Well, I don't think Ken mentioned himself and Craig, so that makes 21.
Well, I have both written on my list, though. So
okay,
I still have 19 names, including Ken and myself.
I'll run down the list again, Craig, and see if he's missing anybody. T.F. Soto, Mark Curtich, Pat McGuire, Dave Schlesinger, Sheila, Casey, Frank Kolopko, John O'Malley, Robin Horton, yourself, Lorenzo, Cheryl, Sue Serpa, Dick Attlee, Dwayne Deeds, Barton Bruce, Ned Delaney, Lynn Bradley, Paul Zaremka, Barbara Honegger, Kit Bedford.
Did you say Dwayne Deeds? Did I hear you say Dwayne Deeds?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I did not know Dwayne was on. And also I didn't have Cheryl down, so
okay.
I now have 21.
Okay. Well, I think somebody might have dropped off in the attempt. That's okay. All right, so we're ready for the season, and the first item of business, as always, is to approve the minutes of previous teleconferences circulated with the draft agenda and put out earlier by Craig. Any objection to approving those minutes? Hearing none, the minutes are approved, and we'll move on to the draft agenda for tonight. Are there any amendments to the draft agenda as circulated?
Yeah, I have an amendment.
Who's speaking, please?
This is Sheila.
Sheila, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that that really the way the agenda came out was misleading. There's something that people haven't been told, and I think an important detail is pointed out, that it says, the agenda says that Mark sent me, let's see, holding on one second, an open offer to debate on the teleconference and that I did not answer. I didn't feel that the offer that he gave me was a genuine offer. I had reasons for not taking it seriously. What he wanted was to have a discussion of his precise accusations. What he literally says is, if they, meaning me and Craig, are willing to limit the discussion to these precise accusations, I'm in. And there would be no discussion of the crisis actor hypothesis. I didn't feel it would be possible to really discuss the situation with Jeff Bauman and the evidence against him being a real person without also bringing in all of the evidence, or some of the evidence at least, that pertained to crisis actors, that shows that there were crisis actors there. So,
I just want that to be... Okay. Well, I was going to... Okay. But, okay, so that has to do with my comments on the front of the agenda, but it doesn't have to do with the agenda itself. So you wanted to make that clear, if that's your position with respect to what I stated on the comments, right?
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to make it clear what was actually offered to me. What was that? And that a choice, you know, I did contact Mark and ask and tell him I would be interested in doing a genuine debate, and he wasn't interested. He said he just wanted to do it on his own. So
yes,
I think that people should understand that.
Yeah, we need to clarify, though, since you're stating that, because I was going to mention this as well, that that was not done until after the draft agenda was published on Saturday. Okay, so
that's true. That is true.
Okay.
And I contacted him at that point and said that I realized I'd been mischaracterized, and I contacted him and said I would be willing to do it.
Okay.
Also, Jim Fetzer contacted him and was invited both of us on his radio show.
Okay, that's
to
not relevant
discuss
to the
it.
Agenda, Sheila, that's not relevant to the agenda. We're just right now trying to figure out what we're going to do with tonight's call. And do you have anything that you need to add or subtract from the agenda?
No.
Okay, thank you. All right, anybody else have anything to add or subtract from the agenda for tonight? All right, hearing none, then we'll proceed with tonight's agenda. And that would be, the first item would be Lynn Bradbury, item postponed from the last teleconference, the 28 pages critical group. So Lynn and Cheryl and Dick will make a short presentation and take questions. So Lynn, it's your floor. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Lynn. Last summer, a group of us were meeting via teleconference or telephone group conference, and regarding our concerns of the direction that the 28 pages movement is taking. And
there's a whole lot of background noise. There's somebody's phone here, like a lot of sneezing or something. If that's you, please press star 6, and then others won't need to hear your bodily functions. Okay, thank you.
So I start again.
Star 6, please, whoever's making the background noise. You can't hear Lynn with that going on. Star 6, please.
Everybody should press star 6 except for
everybody me. Press star 6 unless you're Lynn or me, okay, please. Or Cheryl or Dick. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, proceed.
This is Lynn. Last summer, a group of us were meeting via telephone conference call regarding our concerns that the direction of the 28 pages movement was taking. And it resulted, at least partially, in an article published at Global Research by Ken, Dick, and Cheryl. And Cheryl can update you further.
Okay, yeah. So we sent that letter, then we sent the Les and his group, the 28 pages group, but the two Les, a letter sharing our concerns, which we had been sharing all along in emails anyway, but we kind of formally sent a letter asking them to modify their website so that it included, you know, aligned with the 9/11 truth movement. They really were basically following the official conspiracy theory of the government and what Bob Graham was putting out. And so Les responded to us and really just basically defended himself and didn't make any significant changes to their website that I could see or to their approach. And then on September, this was in August, on September 30th, the Saudis were taken off the lawsuit by the family members, et cetera. And then there was not much, not many 28 pages emails coming out. And to my knowledge, they didn't have any meetings during several months thereafter that. And then it seems like the Saudi issue got revived again in this past spring, February, March. A lot of like geopolitical stuff around the oil and finances and stuff, and so the conversation on email started up again, and then there was more media attention on all of this, the 28 pages, and then there was the Escobar article, and there was Kevin Barrett had done an interview on, I think it was Press TV, and James Corbett had done an interview, basically all supporting the position that we take about the 28 pages as a limited hangout. And the response from those who follow Les's approach there, where they're going along with the official story, they were doing a lot of misrepresentation of these videos and articles, kind of distracting from what the real message was. And then Wayne and Les brought up the first letter that we sent back in August, and Wayne accused us of being anti-28-pagers. We asked, the group of us there asked for a retraction of that statement, and Wayne went about trying to explain himself rather than retract. He finally did retract the statement, and then he also tried to offer to do a website for us as long as we didn't criticize the Les group and their approach, and we didn't think that that was, you know, we didn't want to be restricted to that and have someone else control our website and put those limits on us, so we turned that down. I think Wayne was also upset with Frank and I were on the board. He kicked us off the board of the 9/11 Truth Outreach. He said it's not over this issue, but I can't see any other reason for it. So anyway, and the timing seemed to indicate that. So, and then a few other things that have happened that were disturbing to us is that in the last New York September conference, Les asked Wayne Madsen not to talk about Israel. Sander Hicks in that group has called Berlin, when Berlin was speaking in New York, he called him anti-Semitic. This past week at the Les Forum, he called him a Jew hater. There was some stuff with Chris Grunier in Massachusetts. He picked up Berlin at the airport or the bus station, wherever, and was telling him how what he was doing was all wrong and he shouldn't be doing it. And then, you know, Barry Kissin came out with some flyers stating that the Saudis did 9/11, you know, with no other information there. So we became very concerned by all of this and decided to create our own website. And Dick Atlee is going to tell you a bit about the website that we're creating.
So the website, we will be creating a domain to go with it. We've been toying with various names for it, but we were planning to get the domain after the development site has fully populated, or at least populated enough that we feel can go public. So right now we're working on a development directory and another site, and the basic organization of the site is four questions that we sort of respond to in that site. One is, why is the focus on 28 pages a serious problem? And the second one is, what background lies behind the 28 pages? And this will include the history of the joint committee, who the players were on that committee, what their significance is, and what is and isn't in that committee's report, and how the various parts came to be classified. The third question is, what about the Saudis? Which has two parts to it. One is, why is this sure happening now, 13 years after the report? Now, I guess 14 years, 13 and a half. And the second part of that is, why is the likelihood that the Saudis actually, what is the likelihood that the Saudis actually had a significant role? That is, what are the claims that the Saudis did, or what are the likelihood of claims that the Saudis did, and what would there be to gain, qui bono, on their part? For us, it seems like there's virtually nothing the Saudis could gain from direct involvement in 911. And this stems in a large part of the motivation, which we deal with in the first question about why this is a serious problem. From our point of view, the hijackers are irrelevant. They are a total lie, basically. There were no hijackers. I mean, there were no hijacked planes, and whether the hijackers were involved in this or not is, you know, another question, and whether they're alive or not is another question. But the point is, the hijackers weren't the ones who did 911, and therefore anyone who claims that involvement with them constituted doing 911 is pulling a fast one on us. So that is, I think it's fair to say, and others can contradict me if they want, that that's sort of central to our concern. The last one is, what significant other players have shown up since 2001 with all the 911 truth research, and how likely are they to be accurately portrayed in the 28 pages? And we have currently three possibilities. One is Pakistan. Again, looking at, you know, what's the likelihood they could have been involved, what they stood to gain. The American neocons, which we think is highly likely, and Israel, which there are many, many things pointing to them. And we have on our Israel page, we have a disclaimer pointing out that questioning the role of Israel in anything has absolutely nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It has to do with the national government of Israel and the nationalist orientation of that, and the geopolitical nationalist orientation of it. So that's basically where we're headed at this point. The website is partially populated at this point, and there are various people out on assignment doing the research to fill in the rest of the blanks, and we're hoping to get it off the ground fairly quickly. That's it.
Okay. Lynn, did you want to say anything else?
Lynn Fredberg? No. I think they've summed it up quite well.
Okay. So if people are interested in the project, is there any place that they can get in touch with the group?
Yeah, I guess they can write to you or to Cheryl or to me. That there are 8 people involved in this, and our discussions about the site are closed at this point. We're not going to be publicizing it until it's ready to go. If someone's got questions about it, you know, they can contact Ken or Cheryl or me or Lynn, and we'll do our best to answer it, but we are not public at this point.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that report. Does anybody have any questions or comments on what you've heard?
Barb, I have a question.
Barb, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to know if you are able to say at this point, what are the possibilities you're considering for the domain name, or what would be in the link?
The domain, basically, when we wrote the article that appeared in Global Research last September, the title of it involved misdirection. In writing the article, we'd had discussions about this, but the basic concept is one of a magician who manages to direct your attention to something else so that certain other things can happen and leave you confused about what was going on. So the chances are that it probably will be something like 28 pages misdirection, something along that line. And then we will get the domain, and we've got direct plans for how to set up the web service on that, so that'll happen fairly quickly.
Okay, well,
we
if
might.
You do that, my comment would be, I had no idea what the word misdirection meant. I had no idea that it had anything to do with a magic trick. There might be a better name, and maybe people on this group, if they come up with ideas, send them to Dick.
Yeah, we came up with, I have here, 19 different proposals for names. So if anyone wants to try and get a duplicate of that or something new, by all means, contact us. But misdirection.
The nice thing about misdirection is that we could have, this is Bill, we could have a mascot and call her Misdirection.
Who's going to leave the eye out and make it Ms.?
Okay.
No, well,
thank you. We need to move on. Does anyone else have a question or comment on what you've heard?
Dave,
or should we move on to the next one? Dave Schlesinger?
Robin on the stack.
Okay, yeah. Then Robin after Dave. Go ahead, Dave.
A couple things. One of the weaknesses of the term 28 in a URL is you don't know whether it's numbers or letters. I totally respect you folks deciding what you ultimately come up with. In addition, I am struck recently by how most of my life, adult life, I've been seen myself as a left or a pacifist radical, and I've disliked the liberals. And I think it's ironic that in this situation, the left radicals are, not all of them, but most of them are left gatekeepers and exhibiting great cowardice as regarding this issue. But members of Congress, who I certainly do not trust, I don't hate them and I don't trust them. I don't trust anyone I don't know.
Dave, what's the of the 28 pages website?
Almost done. 28 pages.
The
28 pages, the members of Congress are worried about being killed, whereas the left radicals are not. They're just cowards.
How do you know that?
I don't know for sure. That's my opinion.
Okay, thank you. Robin, you're next. Go ahead, please. Keep it short.
Yes, first, kudos to and my congratulations and admiration for Cheryl and this group to keep on doing what they're doing regarding the 28 pages. My second point would be, don't be surprised at who you find to be gatekeepers who have been with this program for 15 years not appearing to be so. The example best being Israel, the closer we get to the truth in Israel, the more people who you thought were on our side were actually gatekeepers to be used into the future. And then the last thing I would say is I think there was a comment made in presenting this situation that there were no planes, and this is just something that is too premature to make such an assertion. So thank you.
I think you misunderstood there. I don't think he said there were no planes. I think he said there was no hijack planes, and that's
he said both.
Well, let Dick answer. Dick,
can you
clarify?
No, what we're saying is that there were no hijackings. There were no hijackers and no hijackings. That's all we're saying. I think most of us believe there were planes, but of course that's irrelevant to what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Dick. Okay so we're out of time for this issue, so let's move on to our next agenda item, and that would be a report on the 9/11 in deep state presentations at the Left Forum event in D.C. We want to just ask those who are on the call, who were present there, who made either presentations or were involved in the organization, to just say a few words in summary of how they thought the event went and whether they thought headway was made in getting the 9/11 truth issue in front of the left. So who would like to, who that was there would like to make a comment?
This is Kat, and I can speak to that.
Okay,
It was a very successful six panels. The Left Forum has about 3,000 people come, and there's over 300 panels. So we only had six, but we had really good advertising. We had a half-page ad in the program brochure. We came out panels. We had a table, and can you please... we had a table where the speakers got to sell their books, and we were our table was in the main area with all of our messaging had deep state on it, so we had uniform messaging. It was just really well organized and well attended, and we got Cheryl and I. This is Pat speaking. Cheryl Curtis and I mostly did all of the organizing, everything connected with it. And we got a lot of really good feedback. We worked with Alan Reese from No Life Radio, and so we live streamed all of it, and all six channels are now on YouTube. Will someone please mute? All six channels are now on YouTube and No Life Radio. And we had some of the best speakers around. We had Kevin Barrett came to town and spoke, Michael Springman, Richard Dolan, Chris Emery, who is the producer of A Noble Lie about Oklahoma City, Russ Baker, William Pepper gave a great talk, and then Jim Fetzer came in, and Gerard O'Colmain was, and Barbara Honegger, of course, Gerard O'Colmain spoke from Paris. So it was just really, really excellent, and we were really pleased with it. It ended up costing Cheryl and me $500 each to put this on, and we had no budget, and so that was just straight out of our pockets. But we both felt that it was really worth it. It was a lot of hard work for the two of us. You get some help from others. But the most important thing is we had very good attendance, and now we have six fabulous channels. One is on false flags. Another is on the global war on terrorism, which included Fester on ISIS. He was a star. 9/11 panel. Barbara Honegger just knocked it out of the ballpark with her response in that to the 28 pages. We had a panel on assassinations and their cover-up. The panel on COINTELPRO, post 9/11. First they came for the Muslims. And then we had one on Islamophobia, fallout for failure to challenge the proxy role of Muslims in 9/11. So it was an overall success, and we will probably do it again now that we have everything down.
And this is Cheryl, if I could just add that of the six panels, the panel that we did on 9/11 had the highest attendance of 45 people. And that was in spite of the fact that at the last minute the room got changed to a whole other building. But we did. We had the most people in that. And I wanted to thank Frank because he did the moderating for that. And he did a great job. And Barbara did a great job on it. And Kevin Barrett actually took on Chomsky in that one and did a great job of that, too. And I know that there was one man who is upset with that. He got upset that we were challenging Chomsky. He's sending emails out now about that. So that was kind of interesting. But, excellent. The whole thing was really excellent.
Thank you, and sincere congratulations.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you all for the marvelous job. I personally was able to watch it, a lot of those live streamed ones. Do you know how many hits they got, by the way, on No Life Radio?
The last time I looked, they were up to almost 1,000.
Good.
On one of them, but that was a few days ago.
Yeah,
they're not. Tribute to you. You each put in a $500.
Well, we didn't plan it that way. It just turned out that way.
So did you get much of that back from other donors, or are you kind of short of it by yourself?
No, that's after we got stuff back. That is net. We ended up both in the hole, $500.
Oh, my gosh. Well, if people want to help out, can they? How would they do that?
Well, there's enough things to contribute to. We're just going to eat it.
Yeah, we're okay.
Wow.
Okay,
well, let's give them a standing ovation, everybody.
Wow. Okay. Woo. Maybe next year we do it again, we will ask for people to help us out with that. But
that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
It is phenomenal. It was a marvelous job. It was. Okay, well, thank you for the report, and that brings us to our next item.
I actually wanted to raise something.
I just have
a question.
Mm-hmm.
Barb, can I ask a question?
Go ahead, Barb.
Okay. Well, I would hope I happen to know this, but if Kat or Cheryl could let people know about the synchronicity with the room for the dinner, I think it's great.
Oh, that was wild. Yeah.
Oh.
We were in the restaurant, and there were 26 of us on three different tables, and all of a sudden we looked up, and on the wall above our tables was a metal sculpture of the Twin Towers.
What?
And the whole World Trade Center complex.
Yeah. Our Twin Towers, it was just a diner, and when I looked at it, I had no idea. And it wasn't until halfway through the dinner someone pointed up, just look at the art, and there's the Twin Towers.
Where were you eating?
It's a diner, Olympic slang, it's nothing.
Oh, my. Mascot.
Okay, Dave, did you want to make a quick ask a quick question or make a quick comment?
Quick comment. I just wanted people to know the history of this situation. 3 years ago, Wayne Costi and I had a table at the Left Forum. 2 years ago, Wayne Costi and Bob McElvain and I did a presentation about Islamophobia in 9/11 at the Left Forum. Last year, there were four presentations, and this year, there were six that were mentioned, plus two more. Two or three, depending how you define it, other truther-oriented presentations.
Okay, well, that sounds like momentum is moving along, so thank you for that historical background.
Thank you.
Yep,
Robin,
you
on the
again
back.
Robin, go ahead.
Yes, again, congratulations for everybody did this. It was very, very good. I was going to mention what Dave mentioned because he's been doing that for years. And kind of softened up the thing. And I will also just say, hopefully, we can indeed do the same thing as architects and engineers are doing to the AIA conference, and then just be there and just kind of do it. And Chomsky is the most sophisticated left gatekeeper for Israel ever, and you have to commend Barrett for taking him on. I've had beers with Chomskyites at the People's Republic of Cambridge, with the C being a reverse K, and you have no idea, okay, the lemmings that group are. So this is all good. Thank you again. Well done.
Okay.
Yes, and this is Barb. I just want people to know a phenomenal fact about Alan Reese, that he did all of this live streaming, which requires him, I know this, because he set me up on Google Hangouts in advance to be on by remote. He has to sit up in a chair to do it, and he had just had spinal surgery.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So a real standing ovation to
yes, absolutely. And if anybody goes on to their, that's where these presentations are archived. If you go to the No Lies Radio and watch them, be sure to consider making a donation while you're there, okay, because they need the support, and they're definitely a fixture in the 9/11 Truth Movement, so please consider helping them out while you're there, because they did an outstanding job of coming
in. In the minutes, it would be great to have the direct link to the six channels, and I can send it to you, or one of us can send it to Craig to get on the minutes.
Okay. Okay, if you would, Barbara, please. We should have that in a minute so that people can apprise themselves of that. Okay, thank you, Barbara. All right, so we need to move on because we're way past time already. And our next item on the agenda is Mark McCurtich, who took exception to claims made in a previous presentation by, I think it was Sheila Casey, regarding the reality of Jeff Bauman, or legitimacy of the Jeff Bauman story. So he's going to present his version. There was a PDF included with the draft agenda that gives you some of the references that Mark will be using in his presentation. But Mark, if you'd like to just go ahead. Mark is, by the way, a resident of Boston as a 9/11 truth activist there. So go ahead, Mark.
Great, thanks. I'm assuming I'm Star 6 in, right?
I'm sorry?
You can hear me, right? I just want to make sure I start fixing myself back in, so.
Oh, yeah, we're
curious. You're
okay.
Great. Okay. So, first of all, thanks for giving me this opportunity. I'd like to approach this and break it up into two segments. One is just some of the basic facts that I was able to dig up about Jeff Bauman, and then after that, I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple of the photographs, but I think they need to be separated out from my end. This is the one try to put those two conversations back together, that's fine. But so when I listened to the teleconference, Sheila made a few points, and I'm not really quite sure about Sheila's remark tonight about my request being disingenuine. I was very clear about what I was concerned with. She made some pretty basic statements, and I'll repeat them here. They're in the PDF that was sent around, but she said verbatim, Jeff Bowman is a made-up name. And she followed that up with, there is no Jeff Bowman. And she also doesn't seem to know where he were. So I want to take those three points and talk about those first. I knew that as a resident, as somebody who's watched media, both in national media and local media, I know a lot about Jeff Bowman. Never been called upon to defend any of those positions with documentation, but I figured, why not? So, as my outline shows, we know where he went to high school in Chelmsford, Mass. We know his father's name, which is also Jeff. We know he liked to play guitar, and there are a lot of musicians out there that said a lot of different things about him. We know he worked in a delicatessen in Costco, New Hampshire. That was all over both local media and the international media. And a year later, he went back to work. So what we have here is a really simple falling into place of every possible, let's say every possible, every logical fact a cursory look into his existence would require. And it just plays out exactly the way the story has been told. So, and when you add on to that the injuries and all of the reporting that was done on the different hospitals that people went to, and his name keeps coming up there, and even spoke at the hospital they treated at, I'm not really sure what anybody, not just Sheila, but anybody gets off saying this man didn't exist and was not injured the way he was claimed to have been injured. So that is it. Anybody have any questions or want to challenge me on some of the documents? I can't really, I'm not going to go through every single website or citation that I came up with, but I did come up with a cross-section. So they go from everything from YouTube to USA Today, from the UK Daily Mail to Facebook to the Union Leader. I made sure that the cross-section of references so that I'm not pulling everything from Fox or CNN or anything like that, and it all falls into place. So, and this is important because the Jeff Bowman story is the heart of the fake blood correction factor theory. And if Jeff is really a real person, then that theory doesn't really stand on much. I guess I could get into the next part of it, which is the two photographs. And I got a separate thing to say about each photograph. I'm not sure where to begin, but the particular wheelchair photograph first. There's lots of versions of that photo out there. I looked them up. The best one is obviously bought by Getty Images, which tends to buy all the good images. But they're all very similar. And, you know, I do want to make one comment here about Sheila's presentation. First of all, her piece at Truth and Shadows is extremely well written. So I do want to give her credit for being knowing how to craft words. The serious problem I have with it, though, is that it just reiterates information that first appeared the day after the event on blogs. So as far as any facts are concerned, there are no more facts in her article than there were the day after the bombing. And the other thing which is interesting about Sheila's thing is it's one of the earliest pieces out there. I mean, it was May 8th when it was published, which is only 3 weeks after the event. And given how well written and how well documented it is, it took a little while to put that together. So Sheila was right on this story right from the very beginning, and you want to call her one of the original proponents of this story. So so back to the wheelchair image. A couple of the questions she asked during the in her presentation at Truth and Shadows is, you know, questions like, where are they going, why is it in a wheelchair, yada, yada, yada. Well, and where are the ambulances? The ambulance thing keeps coming up, and I'm going to tell you something. You know, as a resident of downtown Boston, most streets are narrow. And where is Jeff Bowman in that picture? Jeff Bowman is about 25 feet from Dartmouth Street, which is right on the edge of where the main tent is, the main medical tent. So when they're racing down, when you see them, and especially if you look at Arredondo, and their eyes are focused on something, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're focused on the back of the ambulance that they're racing towards. Because there were no, it would be, from a, you know, one of the things I'd like people to try to employ in analyzing this stuff is using a little bit of common sense, is it doesn't make sense to flood that area with ambulances. I mean, you have all kinds of people running around crazy that are trying to leave, other people trying to get in. And to clear that out to get an ambulance, a lot of people would just be waiting forever. So it, to me, I think the wheelchair, although nothing I want to point out about wheelchairs is one of the reasons why wheelchairs are so commonly used is that there are a ton of wheelchairs at the end of the marathon. Typically, a lot of runners are just dead fatigued at the end, so they always have a huge supply of ambulances, not ambulances, of wheelchairs at the end of the marathon. So I'm guessing that that out of expediency, they grabbed the wheelchair and said, this kid doesn't have any time to wait. We've got to get him to the medical tent as soon as possible. So that's my take. That's a take not really based on much except from going to the marathon a bunch of times and knowing where all this stuff is. So that on the wheelchair photo. And then as far as the blood on the ground with his leg just lying there, that's a very interesting photo, and I'm going to challenge both Sheila and Craig on this, but I don't know what the source of that photograph is, because I looked pretty hard, and I can't find the original photographer or original media source on that. And I'm not saying that it's not a legitimate photograph, but I couldn't find a source. And I spent a little time, too. I mean, I went a few pages deep into Google looking for a source, and it just didn't come up. And I looked for images several times a week. As a professional, so I know how to do it. I have a guess of where that photo came, but it's just an educated guess. But in any event, the blood that you know, she pointed out, look at the high-res Melissa's image, and I have a Mac cinema monitor, and I have a high-res monitor, and I opened it up, and what's interesting about the blood is, yes, some of it's real red, and some of it is starting to dry. As Bill Wolf points out, it starts turning dark, whatever, there's several shades of blood on that sidewalk. So I honestly think you're looking at Jeff Bowman's blood. That's exactly what you're seeing. That's a lot of blood. I think one of the reasons why it's so red is because it's still very, there's a lot of it there. It's really thick. Another important thing to consider about that photo of him just lying there, which quote-unquote unattended, is that, and Sheila did point this out, and I think she's actually accurate, it does look like a man in military fatigue and a policeman guarding this kid, and I'm going to guess that they are guarding him and calling out to make sure that medical attention gets to him immediately, because Dr. Painter went around and put a C on his forehead with his own blood, meaning he was in critical condition, so that was one of the things that he did to sort of separate out who needed him the attention and who didn't. Again, if you have the original image, you could get the metadata on it, or you just knew the photographer and knew the exact time when the photo was taken, a lot of questions could be answered, but I didn't see it in Sheila's presentation. So, and to give Sheila a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, although not much in this case, her original post was written on May 8th, and some of the information that I brought up, I mean, Jeff didn't even go back to work a year after, Sheila wrote that post, The Truth and Shadows, but her comments the last week, and she just, put a chapter in a book, or contributed to a book, so one would think that she would update her information by now, and at least check the references, she made some claims of what, I'm guessing that Sheila, wrote this thing in May of 2013, has not followed up on any of this stuff, and is now putting a chapter in a book about this, and it really bothers me, because this is all very well documented stuff.
Mark, you're at about 10 minutes. Do you want to open up?
No, that's it. I mean, I could go on and on. Right. I'll be glad to answer any questions. And the one thing I did want to say is the graphic designer who worked with millions of photographs. Color, people you work with photos, you're trying to get flesh tones right all the time. It's like it's an art that no one in photo will ever perfect. So to get things like flesh tone and blood color right and whatever. This is the internet world. I mean, everything gets destroyed. It gets compressed and ruined on the internet. So, There isn't much to tell. Everybody's looking at a different monitor. If we all had Apple Cinema monitors, cinema displays, I'd say, okay, everybody's looking at a cinema display. What does it look like? But we got to look. Every person on this call probably has a different monitor, so you can't be telling stuff by that. And it's not just that. The visual image also has to be supported by documentation. And unless you have solid documentation about that, like when it was shot, who shot it, when it was first posted, one more thing I'll conclude with. One thing I did find a story that I heard about and forgot and then now remembered is that Jeff Bowman's, this image, I believe, is the image that Jeff Bowman's father saw and how he first found out that Jeff was injured. And it caused such a stir that I think mainstream media took it off and they stopped showing it. And what's interesting about that photograph, and I challenge anybody, I might be wrong, but I challenge anybody, is go find out, go and see where that photograph is posted. And it's only posted at conspiracy sites that advocate the crisis actor. You'll never see that image posted anywhere else that advocates the official story or any other story. I'm not saying that's necessarily malicious, because like I say, I think what happened is the mainstream took it down out of deference to the family. And conspiracy theorists grabbed it, and they have it, and they keep putting it out. So that's my take.
Okay.
So, anyway. I'll entertain anybody's comments or questions.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be probably a few people that would like to get on the stack here to ask questions or make a comment. But your question needs to be about Jeff Bowman. Okay, we can't go out onto all kinds of tangents here. This is clearly about Jeff Bowman, whether he was a real person or not, whether, and about the evidence that's been presented in the handout and here. Regarding that. So who would like to be on the stack to make a comment or ask a question?
Dick Atlee.
Oh, Robin.
Dick Atlee.
Bruce.
Robin Horton.
Sheila.
Martin Bruce. Sheila.
Bill.
Who else? Bill.
Bill.
Who else? Huh?
Bill.
Bill, I got you, Bill. Who else?
Paul.
Paul, sir, I'm
Paul. Paul, who else?
Martin.
Hello?
Martin, I got
Sorry.
You, Martin.
It's, yeah, Craig. I've been trying to get in, but I didn't realize I kept my line muted. Sorry about that.
Oh, I got you. All right, anybody else? If you should maybe give you a second to get on the stack here. Star 6, if you're muted. Going once, going twice. Okay, please try to keep your comment or your question as brief as you can, because we only have a few minutes more on this issue. But go ahead, Dick, you're first.
Okay, I was looking at the Manchester Union Leader article on the Costco co-employees. I'm not taking a position one way or the other on Mr. Bowman, but there is one thing that jumped out at me in that article, which says Bowman asked for a piece of paper, this is when he's in the hospital, and wrote a note saying he had made eye contact with a man who had placed a bag on the ground just before the first of two bombs exploded near the finish line of the marathon on April 15th. Bauman's subsequent description of the suspect, now known to be Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was critical to investigators' ability to zero in on Tsarnaev and his younger brother, Jokov, from thousands of photos showing countless people. That's a really weird statement, given that the Tsarnaev probably had nothing to do with that. I'm not sure
if you look at the FBI documents, the video documents, they do have Tamerlan fleeing that area. After the explosion,
but they have,
so
they have the
in
wrong
that area.
They have the wrong
whether
color
or not
backpack.
He put a bomb there or not. Huh? Excuse me.
Okay,
they have the wrong color backpack, so there's no question they weren't involved in it.
Yeah. Dick, I think you're making a point, but we are trying to stay here on the question of whether or not Bowman is a real person. Okay,
right.
That's the whole presentation here. Okay, more or less. So we try to stick with that issue. Okay.
And that's a good point. That doesn't really go to address the fact of whether or not.
Can I raise a point of order, Ken, just real quick? I think the scope of Mark's presentation goes well beyond whether Bowman was a real person or not. He basically supported the whole story that involved Bowman. So, I mean, including the identification of the thing that Dick just mentioned. So I think there's got to be a little bit of leeway.
Well, I didn't hear that as part of this presentation, but if you did, Craig, you're welcome to challenge me, but I didn't hear that as part of this presentation.
I think the whole issue of crisis actors was addressed.
That's
and
your
whether,
opinion, but
I'm
only going by what he presented here. What did he present here? He presented evidence that shows Bowman was a real person. I don't hear him going much beyond that in his presentation. If you think
he did,
you're welcome to challenge me.
he did. He presented evidence that they were real injuries. Yes, he did.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, but he didn't go beyond that to talk about other issues. Okay.
There are several people from Boston on this call, and I'm just going to make the statement, and I know this to be true, that the main medical tent at the end of the marathon is about 25 feet from where Bowman is at that moment. And I'll challenge anybody from Boston to tell me that's not true.
Okay.
So if there wasn't, there may not have been an ambulance there, but I know the medical tent is right from
Mark, you need to give, this is time for other people to ask questions or make comments.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, Robin, you're next.
Yeah, first of all, thank you, Mark, for standing up for a single truthful point. It's my observation that COINTELPRO operators keep on tagging on and widening and expanding issues so that they can diminish your point, so good job. Deal with Fetzer at your own peril, and I feel that Barbara Honegger has the best perspective in the fact that some of these deep state events are actually mixed real, okay, and with actors or operators or whatever it might be. And Peter Dale Scott has, after decades of research, has finally figured that out. So Barbara has got an eloquent voice on this. That's all for it.
Well, I'll make a quick comment on that, and I'm going to add a slight little additional tangent comment to that, which is, you know, Barbara's research is about the Pentagon, and Barbara's research has led her to conclude exactly what you just said, Robin. But the difference between Robin and what Sheila or anybody else is presenting is Barbara has a witness, and Barbara has more than one witness. She has witnesses that have experienced things, and she has witnesses that have smelled things.
Mark, I'm sorry. This is taking us too far afield from the.
No, but I'm trying to address the fact that there are no witnesses in any of this. There's no documentation.
Okay.
But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. All right, thanks. Barton Bruce.
Okay. I don't, if I'm going far afield, I don't think I am, but if you don't like it, I'll stop. But I would be pretty disgusted. Because listen to what I've got to say. I'm going to condense what I normally do as a much longer thing. There is a video. We're not talking single picture, although I am aware of chroma bursting or green screening. I didn't see anything that I thought was evidence of it, but I'm not an expert. There's a video that goes on for several minutes. I'll condense it to the relevant parts. Bowman is lying on the ground with his, left stump, short leg, held up in the palm of his left hand with his left elbow on the ground. There is a light, sort of warm little smile, as though he's a crisis actor doing the right thing, or maybe he's on La-La juice, some paramedic shot into him so he wouldn't feel the pain. No evidence that I can see of anything that looks like a tourniquet, but there may be some high-tech modern ones which you wouldn't even see. I don't know. He's lying there on his back. There are people standing, sitting, squatting, whatever, all around. The only person who's really moving is the guy in a hoodie who's back to us, who seems to be, occasionally moves ahead to inspect his handiwork, taking a little brush and dotting blood on the face of a woman in a wheelchair. Behind her, there are people running by from the right to the left, going down Bowes Street to the finish line. That's where they might have been green screened into a stage at other event, although I doubt it. After a while, nothing else has happened. Mr. Hoodie puts his right hand up, palm to the right, away from us, where you can't see anything else. No other hands are visible, and nothing happens. Not 20 or 30 seconds later, probably at least 45, but not like a minute or two. Bowman's right hand goes up, palm in the same direction, off stage to the right, and immediately it's rock and roll time. Everybody who's standing, sitting, squatting starts moving, except Bowman. Bowman's still lying there.
Fine, you're eating up time. You've got to decide.
Yeah.
This is,
the smoke stops. The smoke tapers off immediately.
There are chalk board masking
tape marks on the ground for everywhere. Everybody standing, sitting, or lying. It's a marked stage.
I can't find
the video, but I will.
And the one thing, simple in response to that,
I think you should let him finish. This isn't fair.
He wasn't allowed to finish.
Okay, Mark,
I'm
please
finished
take
now.
Your...
I probably have the video, and I'm going to find it.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Barton. And Mark, make a very brief response, and then we need to keep moving, please. Thank you.
It's one man's interpretation of what he thinks he sees in the video, and he's trying to defend documentation of how that this person is alive. And that doesn't, in every form that I've ever encountered, you can't argue that way. I'm sorry. It's just...
Okay, thank you. Okay, Sheila, you're next.
Okay. I have two comments and a question. First of all, for Mark, you list a URL here for allhighschools.com/alumni/search/Chelmsford High School.
Right.
What did you find when you went there?
Jeff Olmane graduated, 2004.
Because what I find when I go there is it says, this page is here because someone searched for this name. They're not claiming at all that he ever went to that school. They're just saying they created a page because somebody searched for the name.
I think you.
There's nothing here to indicate that he went to that high school. Nothing at all.
It says he graduated in 2004.
Well, that could be so, but there's nothing here on that page that would give any indication. I could search for your name, and they would create a page for you.
Huh?
Well, I'm losing here.
Okay, thank you. Your next
question. No, that was my question, and I also have two comments.
Okay.
The articles that I read did not mention the location of the Costco. I read mainly articles that were in the national press. I don't generally read the New Hampshire or Boston newspapers.
Right.
So I can't say that no newspapers indicated what Costco he works at. All I can say is the articles I read did not indicate.
Can I
please finish, Mark?
Mark, let her make her comments, and then you can respond, okay?
Okay.
So the articles I read did not indicate, and this was not at all the focus of my article. The article was 4,000 words as it was. This is very long. What I did was an analysis of the photos and the video from that day and put together a chronology of what happened based on the photographic record. So that was not something that was part of my article. I did my best to answer a question that came to me after the presentation, and that was my understanding of it, was that they had not given the specific Costco. Clearly I was wrong, but I had not read those specific newspaper articles that mentioned which Costco he worked at. So I would also like to say that every false flag has had legions of people, traitors, who are willing to support the official story. In 2002, I watched a BBC movie called Why the Towers Fell, and they trotted out. I remember thinking to myself way back in 2002, that was really funny how those towers came down. How could they collapse all the way to the sidewalk because of damage at the 92nd floor? It doesn't make any sense. And I sat and watched this thing called, you know, Why the Towers Fell, and they trotted out one highly paid professional after another, structural engineers, building safety analysts, different firemen, a professor of fire protection engineering, all willing to support the official story that, yes, those fires, those buildings fell because of office fires. So I would just say that if you are trying to give us proof that Jeff Bauman exists because there are people out there who say so, every single false flag has had numbers and numerous people, like all of these people who were quoted and appeared on Why the Towers Fell, who have been, for whatever reason, have been willing to support the official story. And I don't know exactly how they do it. Maybe they threaten them. Maybe they pay them. Maybe some of them are put into position. But I don't think that personal testimony in support of the official story is all that compelling.
Okay. Thank you, Sheila. You know what I mean? You want to respond quickly, Mark?
Yeah. I mean, you're saying that people, you're comparing people who say that they know this person, that they treated this person, that they had direct contact with this person. You're comparing them to engineers from 2001 who agreed on an opinion. This is not a fact. This is not an existential reality. It's an opinion. And how that opinion was influenced is certainly up for debate. But to compare that to eyewitnesses, people the kid played guitar with, his family members who made a video with pictures of him going all the way back as a kid. I mean, it's not a fair comparison. And this is what I don't like about this, what I find very problematic about this argument, is people do it, gotta bring up Sandy Hook or something else, because there are no witnesses. There is not a single witness to any of these claims. They are claims that have been fabricated since April 16th, 2013, and not one witness has come up to verify this claim. Unlike, for instance, the molten metal claim, which is the one I want to compare, and this is where I'm going to end this, is with, we have witnesses all over the place saying there was molten metal. And then John Gross turns around in Texas, and somebody asks him about molten metal, and he lies to his face, and he says, I never heard of molten metal. Show me where there was molten metal. This is an instance
okay.
where we have
Mark,
documented facts.
Keep it short, okay, Mark? Because I'm sorry,
yeah,
we're very short on time. So, all right.
That's it.
All right, thank you.
No,
I think you made your point. Bill, please keep your comment or your question very short, and Paul and Craig as well. Go ahead, Bill.
The only question that I have is, how can we prove when Mark Bellman lost his legs? It's when did the amputation occur? Were there spare parts in the street that would be in the military? Was there any accident that he had in his life before this?
That was it.
Okay, you want to respond to that, Mark?
Of all the people who have said they've known them, which is a lot of people, no one has mentioned any of it. So I guess common sense tells you he doesn't have to hide. Nothing to hide. And that video, I mean, I'm a little bit insulted by this, but the video, I'm glad I found it. The video his family put out right in the middle of it, he's sitting there, you know, as a teenager with his legs. So, Bill, if you're saying that he blew up his legs between when he was 16 and when he was 27, then you're going to have to prove it, because he's got plenty of evidence that he is who he says he is. So.
Well, but didn't he have his legs when he was working at the Costco store right before that?
I would imagine.
Isn't that what people are saying, that knew him there?
Right, and like I said, I think some common sense needs to be applied here. And dismissing common sense as going with the official story is pretty lame too. So.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Paul, you're next.
Yeah, the only one thing, two things. Mark, I want to commend you on your work, providing the evidence that you have provided, and the comment I wanted to make to Sheila is I would like Sheila to head on, not talk about 9/11 or anything else, meet head on his evidence. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Paul. And Craig.
Thanks, love you.
What specific thing do you want me to address, Paul? Is there something in particular?
His evidence that Jeff exists and that he was injured that day. I mean,
well, it seems to me that all this evidence comes from the media, and if we were to take the media as our last word of the truth, well then, you know, they were hijackers. The 19 hijackers are 19 Muslim hijackers are the reason that those buildings came down. According to the media, according to the same media that he is quoting, according to the New York Times, according to the LA Times, according to virtually all media, so I don't see why suddenly we're trusting the media on this issue that we don't trust them on anything else.
Okay, well,
can I be added to the list?
Okay, we don't need a side to we shouldn't have a side to debate here. This is really
I'll give one
Mark tonight. So Craig, you're next. Go ahead.
Well, I'll try to be quick. First of all, I was a bit troubled by Mark's use of the term conspiracy theory sites and saying they keep putting the photo up. I don't know who conspiracy theory sites are. That sounds like something that someone would say if they were, you know, sort of putting the idea down. Perhaps I misread that. I mean, there are many media accounts of what happened to different people that day, and many of them can be demonstrated not to match up with the video evidence. And I think a lot of this was covered in Dave McGowan's series. You know, people who were interviewed in mainstream newspapers who talked about, you know, their wife being next to them or something happening or somebody losing a limb or something. And then you see the video, and the video absolutely does not corroborate what they said in those interviews. So I think there are many reasons to be suspicious of the whole story. Whether Jeff Bauman is actually a person or not is definitely something that should be looked at for sure, but it's not the whole story. I mean, there are, you know, we're supposed to believe there were 264 people injured, and I think that that's a wildly high number. Given what we've seen in the video as well. And there are people like, if anybody's seen this photograph of a guy named Bim Costello sort of walking around the streets. He looked like somebody, he appeared to have no injuries. I know this is not Jeff Bauman.
He hasn't made any of these contentions. He's only contending that Jeff Bauman is real. But try to keep your comments focused on that, okay?
Well, I'm keeping my comments on the faking of injuries and the faking of this story that all these people were actually injured, which I think he made reference to in general terms a few times. But okay,
I really didn't. Jeff Bauman is the heart of this story, and he is. He's the heart of this story. So I'm gonna watch.
He is the heart of the story because yes, without him we wouldn't have the Sarnaev brothers, would we? He's the guy. Not only is he the visual heart of the story, with the iconic photograph of him being pushed down the street in a wheelchair, and the whole story, the Carlos Arredondo story, is absolutely the story that he gave to the media. Absolutely is contradicted by the video evidence. What he says he did. Okay, so we have this iconic photograph that's all forever going to be identified with this event. And it just happens to be the same guy who broke the whole case and found these two Muslims from Chechnya.
He didn't break the case. And the way that story goes is that they already had pictures of Zokar and Tamlin. They already had pictures of him. They thought this was him, and he confirmed it, and that's what pushed the cops over the edge to publicize the photograph. But he didn't.
They thought it was him based on what? Based on what did they think that they had the right guys?
Well, you saw the video. Zokar walks up with that one.
Two guys walking down the street, a few feet apart, with backpacks.
No, the one that they presented at the trial. The one that they presented at the trial.
Okay.
They had that video.
And that video told them that they had the guys that planted the bomb.
It's a suspect. It would lead me to believe he was a suspect.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And Dave, if you want to take a turn here, Dave, it has to be less than 30 seconds because we're way over time. Okay. So go ahead.
No problem. I just looked up on the classmates, and there is somebody named Jeff Bauman at Chelmsford High School in Massachusetts, listed as having graduated high school in 2004. I am not a supporter of the official story on the Boston bombing, but that
Dave,
I looked up.
Dave Schlesinger. Excuse me.
I just looked it up. Jeff Bauman did graduate from Chelmsford High School in 2004.
Did he have
according to classmates.
Thank you for your confirmation. Okay. All right.
You had to sign up as classmate, as if you were in that class yourself, didn't you, Dave, to get that information?
No, they have another way around it. But I organize my own high school reunions, and I do pay them.
So Sheila, let me ask you a question. There's a photo that I presented part of the Boston... It's on the Boston Press Photographer's website of a vigil from Chelmsford, Massachusetts for Jeff Bauman. If that photograph is not genuinely what Boston Press Photographers are putting on their site, what is that a picture of?
I don't think that picture proves anything. I don't think any of your evidence proves anything. And I find it very hard to believe that you think that you have proved something.
Well,
I've looked up. You know who's easy to trace is Jeff's mother, or the woman who claims to be a mother to Jeff.
If you're going to prove that a major factor of this experience,
you know what? You're interrupting me. Excuse me.
I know I'm interrupting you. Then you have to prove that everything is a fraud.
I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt here myself. We're out of time on this issue. I would really like to see the two of you debate this question in a formal
way. He's not interested.
No, it's not true he's not interested. He was interested for a whole month and you never responded, Sheila, but now he made his presentation. I would still like to see a debate, however, and I would encourage both of you to consider debating it in the future in a formal
way. I would like 30 seconds to say what I found about his mother, because she has a very, very unusual name, C-S-I-L-L-A. According to Spokio,
she's the only one in the United States, and
she's not related to anybody named Jeff Bauman.
She's his stepmother. Sheila is his stepmother.
She's related to someone who's 57 years old named Jeff Bauman, apparently her husband.
That's her husband, Jeff Bauman Sr.
Yes, and there's nobody else.
That's Jeff's father.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it here because we could get into endless debates about these issues, but I would really love to see both of you consider a formal debate in the future on the whole geofoundment issues. Where we should take these things apart in smaller pieces. So,
Ken, I'm going to have to say something to you, though, Ken, about how you've handled this. You have to realize it's impossible to prove a negative, and you've tried to limit all comments to anything having to do with proving that Jeff Bauman doesn't exist. We know Jeff Bauman doesn't exist because of the totality of the entire event.
Sheila, you're out of order. If you want to raise a point of order, you can do so, but otherwise, please let's move on. Okay, we need to move on. Okay?
Ken, you've handled it really poorly. I'll tell you that much. You've handled it really poorly.
Thank you, Sheila. Okay, now let's move on. The next item on our agenda is nonviolence, empowerment, and organizing. David Schlesinger, you have the floor.
Thanks so much. Okay. I became active in the 9/11 Truth Movement in 2002.
Excuse me just a second, Dave. I should have thanked Mark. I forgot to thank Mark for his presentation. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I became active in the 9/11 Truth Movement in 2002. I was struck immediately by how hostile everyone seemed to be about any discussion of nonviolence. Now, truthers are as hostile to a discussion of nonviolence as left gatekeepers are hostile to a discussion of 9/11 truth evidence. That doesn't mean each of you are, but in general, that is a problem. I found that 9/11 truth folks too often take the position, quote, I'm nonviolent because I didn't hit anybody today, unquote. Since the greatest activists in the last 100 years of world history have been Gandhi and King, and the most notable aspect of their philosophy has been nonviolence, you might be open to the possibility that, quote, I didn't hit anybody today, unquote, is a superficial handling of the subject. The enforced civility on this call, which is the nonviolent aspect of this call, is this call's greatest strength, in my opinion. The issues we debate will not be resolved within the movement. Historians will resolve these issues. And please note, historians are affected by the larger intellectual community, which means we should do outreach. One reason some people are hostile to nonviolence is that they realize they might have to rein in their hatred of enemies. In our case, people who might have to try to curtail hating their real perpetrators of 9/11 and those who cover it up. Communists from India and others who have a class analysis very much show hatred toward Gandhi because he very much advocates suffering to touch the hearts of the adversary. One aspect of this is trying to touch the heart of everyone, including their own supporters. You could call it empowerment, arguing against serving time in jail because the belief, quote, one can do more outside of jail than inside, unquote, ignores one's ability to generate support in the realm of the heart rather than through just logic and evidence. In the history of AE 9/11 Truth, most significant organization in 9/11 Truth history so far, the best team leader was Laura Niebuhr of the verifications team because she loved her team. Once she quit about 2 years ago, it became quite a challenge to process petition signers. The people doing verifications needed that love. I'm sad to admit most of you could seem to act like you care less if the movement grows, happy to hear assurances otherwise. Most truthers do not have a goal of saving the republic or getting justice for the perpetrators. I see the goal of most truthers as being able to say to those who disrespected them, quote, I told you so, unquote. Some disrespect comes from debunkers, and some comes from other truthers. Let me raise, I was going to speak of Jim Hufford because he actually does good stuff. But he writes a regular column for the Grassroots List. And I'm asserting that that essay, because it is read only by choir, is not outreach. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I like all of our posts on various 9/11 Truth Facebook pages should not be considered outreach. Anything seen only by choir does not grow our movement and is not outreach. Correct me if I'm wrong that 99% of what cruisers write is for choir. Who disagrees with that statement? You'll have your you'll make your remarks when I'm done. What we do have is integrity by asking the hard questions about 9/11. What we lack is understanding the value of expanding the movement beyond its current contours. Gandhi even defines his term for activism, satyagraha, as, quote, holding fast to the truth, unquote. When Cheryl and Ken were raising issues about the accuracy of the description of the 28 pages, I suspect Gandhi would have largely stood with them. He took a backseat to no one when it comes to dedication to the truth. Another aspect of nonviolence worth addressing is the tendency for truthers to quickly accuse those they differ with as infiltrators. There are, of course, infiltrators, since our movement is so significantly a threat to those in power. The left, in spite of its cowardice in refusing to look at the evidence, knows better than to accuse other activists of acting in bad faith at the drop of a hat. They call for solidarity rather than unity. Unity is what truthers in their ignorance ask for. It is also what leadership on the left calls for when they want to drum dedicated people out of their Marxist-Leninist sect. Now, truthers never call for solidarity. Most truthers would take umbrage at my suggestion for using the term, quote, misinformation, unquote, rather than, quote, disinformation, unquote. They think I stand against warning the movement when someone poses a danger. I do not. The way to address when someone who is a problem is to criticize what they are saying and what they are doing. That way you don't have to act like you know what is in a person's mind. It also can expose lies. My experience is that dedicated altruistic activists rarely lie. They might be difficult or foolish, but they rarely lie. Let me paraphrase top nonviolence scholar Jean Sharp's position on the danger of police agents. It is not, in my words, it is not their lying or their spying, It is their ability to generate mistrust of genuine activists. Most truthers are dedicated to generating mistrust rather than trust. Too many truthers are too paranoid to even come on this call or sign a petition. They're too paranoid to lobby or leaflet or put videos on cable access. The advantage of leafleting, by the way, is that a person who accepts the leaflet is cooperating by taking that leaflet. We need to create situations where truthers want to show their courage. I call that empowerment. Now, recently I was told that Ken and Craig would stand against further discussion of when I assert I was lied about by certain AE staffers. The two sessions where there was conversation, I was not able to respond. Now, if I am not allowed to expose lies, this suggests contempt for fair play. I will try to resolve this issue off this call. I will still try to, but I may return to raising it. Making it hard for people to be activists should be a cause for concern. Only losers would not want to be concerned, and too many truthers are losers. Now, I'm going to suggest a couple of very specific actions that I will actually be calling many of you who I actually know to see if you would participate. One of them is we're looking for people to leaflet one day in the next year at some college of your choice with our physicsdenial.com website, where we will be encouraging students to challenge their professors that whether or not the official story violates Newton's third law. It'll be a lot to ask students to do such leafleting, but people who are knowledgeable for years should be able to pick one day in the next year when they can go and do such leafleting. The other action is the Martin Luther King situation. Most of us know that the Memphis civil trial in 99 showed, after an hour of deliberations, that Dr. King was not killed by James Earl Ray. He was killed by the federal government and the mob and the Memphis police. So what I'm asking people to do, the website is liesaboutmlk.com, is to get a banner and go in the mid-January to MLK dinners and hold the banner outside, because the problem is that the Atlanta MLK Center, makes no mention of this civil trial. It does mention it on their website, but the million people go through the Atlanta Center every year, and it is the Memphis civil trial is not mentioned. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, David. Does anybody want to make a comment or ask a question?
I have a comment. Barbara.
Barbara. Who else?
Sheila.
Sheila. Who else? All right, I'll put myself last on the list. Go ahead, Barbara.
Yeah, I just have a question or a comment, and that is, Dave, what would you think about the idea of doing something like I did for the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero, the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour that exposes the lies inside the museum using their own exhibit items? You could do that for this MLK exhibit, and you could also expose what's missing in the museum in the walking tour. What do you think?
That's certainly worth discussing. Certainly worth discussing.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. Sheila?
Yeah, Dave, the article that I wrote about the Boston bombing has had 200,000 views online. Do you not call that outreach?
You can make the case that it might be. My point is that the people who read it are people who are leaning in that direction. And if you might be able to make the case that a lot of people who have no opinion are looking at it, in which case then it would be outreach. In general, I mean, you actually could write. I am not so good at it. But in general, we write to each other. And certainly people who put articles in books, that's a little closer to outreach.
I guess I
okay.
just think that for someone like me to stand in a corner handing out leaflets seems where I could, you know, maybe reach, 250 people in a day or in a few hours
that I would be able to do it
seems like such a much more poorer use of my time than actually doing something that could be read by many tens of thousands of people.
Except that you don't write such an article every day. I mean, I don't know how much you write. You're very talented, so you might write a lot. But I'll be calling hundreds of people that I know in the movement, and Richard Gage acknowledged last January that I know more truthers than anyone. And some people hate leafleting, you know, it's okay. But I will find people to go leaflet and hold banners, and, you know, because these are people who have shown dedication over many years. And it's not for everybody, and there's nothing wrong with doing things differently. But sadly, I think we debate among each other, which is what this call is supposed to be about, so I can't fault this call particularly. But most of the Facebook pages where we debate fine points is in place of doing outreach.
Okay. Dave, the last time I made an effort, Robin, last time I made an effort to leaflet on a college campus on a peace and justice issue, I was unceremoniously escorted off by the campus commandos. So I think there's a reason why it's important, even leaflets like that, that you try to get students to do the leafleting, because others really don't have standing on campus when push comes to shove. Just wanted to mention that in passing, Robin.
There are colleges where it's harder. And I just leafleted at Northwestern, where I stood on a public sidewalk and gave out 1,000 cards. It's much harder at my college, MIT, just because of the structure of the of where buildings are and where your sidewalk is. Some colleges allow leafleting, some do not.
Thanks. I didn't need a response. Robin, you're last.
Yes, I'm going to just make a point that I made a while ago, and that is that Dave Schlesinger's overall message is the most important, and that is that outreach is key. I would just offer the fact that there are a wide variety of ways of doing that, and to narrow into one is not particularly the best way to do it. So we should support everybody doing whatever it is and whatever methodology that they use to outreach, and in fact, there should be meetings and organizational thought in coming up with different ideas on how can we do this. I happen to be very successful in where I am in a ferry town in Kingston, Washington, and have given out 3,000 DVDs just myself, and even more than that. So anyways, the message is outreach is an issue, inreach is a problem, and whatever. But I want to make a point that I think is essential that David made, that probably made passed by most people except for me. He made a point, and I'm paraphrasing, that when we spend time trying to figure out what other people or other truthers are thinking. We're trying to read their minds and saying something like, well, if you said this, then you really meant to say that, and that means you said this, and all of a sudden it gets to be personalized instead of doing what David had asked us to do, which is to deal with the positions, the working hypotheses, or whatever it might be. And that's for you, Craig McKee.
Thank you, partner.
What? What the hell was that?
Yeah, what did that mean?
I don't think that was a useful addition there.
Can I say, this is Lynn Bradbury. I tried to get on the stack, but I don't know if you heard me.
Okay, no, I didn't, Lynn. Go ahead, take a turn.
I would like an explanation for that remark.
Yeah, you deserve one.
Fair enough. What did you mean by that?
First of all, I'll keep the remark because I actually wasn't paying attention.
Self-explanatory.
No, it's not self-explanatory, Robin.
It's insulting.
I didn't hear the remark, and I'd like to know what you said, and I'd like to know what you meant by it.
The point that David made is that in the 9/11 truth community, too many truthers and people spend time trying to figure out the intentions or the points of view or what it is the other truthers are actually thinking, meaning that if they say this, the opposite, if a person presenting information says this, there is then too much work put into trying to analyze what that person was actually thinking and what their personality is. And David made a very clear, succinct point. It's simple. That is unproductive. What is productive is to just deal with the information that has been presented.
Robin, we know all that. What are you accusing Craig of?
Why did you mention Craig's name is what the question is.
Because every phone call that I have had ever since he has been engaged in this, he has spent too much time trying to evaluate or devalue what it was that the other person is thinking. And it needs to stop. Just deal with the facts, the evidence, the working hypotheses, and go ahead.
That's just amazing.
Give me one example of that, Robin. Give me one example. I resent that
you replay your presentation tonight and you have an example.
Robin, stop it. You are out of order. Your comment about Craig was entirely out of order. It had nothing to do with the subject at hand. It was a personal comment. And it's insulting to bring things like that up in the course of a civil discussion, okay? You are out of order. If that happens again, I'm going to bounce you off the call. Period.
No problem, Ken.
All right.
Never been a problem.
Now, it's Craig's turn now. Oh, thank you for your presentation, David. Craig's turn now to give us a presentation on Ken O'Keefe visited Montreal and what happened with hate crimes investigation by the Toronto police as their way of welcoming Ken O'Keefe to Canada. So go ahead, Craig.
Okay, I'll try to refocus myself here. So Ken O'Keefe, I imagine a lot of people on the call know who he is. If you don't, I would suggest checking him out. He's certainly very well known for his stance on Israel and Gaza, but he's actually also a very, very strong 9/11 truther, and I think he's definitely somebody that we should be very happy to have in our corner, I believe. He did a speaking tour recently that started off, I think it started in Berkeley, or it's definitely California, and way across the country, and then ended up crossing the border into Montreal and Toronto for three dates in two cities. And as a result of the one in Montreal was pretty quiet, but the one in Toronto, which I was present at both, as was Barry Zwicker. Barry was one of the organizers of the Toronto event, and he put a ton of work into that. So in terms of outreach, I think we should give a tip of the cap to Barry's work. With that, the result of this event is that the Toronto police are investigating whether Canada's criminal code has been violated, the hate propaganda provisions of our criminal code, which I can only say that I'm embarrassed to say that we have this provision. And basically it defines hate speech as, well, it gives two things. One is if you say something that is going to lead to someone breaking the law or harming somebody, that one sort of makes sense. But then the other one says that statements other than in a private conversation that willfully promote hatred against any identifiable group, I think that's obviously highly problematic. And there may not be any charges from this. We have really no idea if that will be the case. I've been in touch with the Toronto Police, and they've been very cagey about that. They have not provided any of the investigating officers to be interviewed. The B'nai B'rith Canada, which is a group that advocates for the Jewish community, has come out on their website calling Ken a neo-Nazi, and they have referred to him as spouting murderous anti-Semitism. I think there's a little bit of irony in the fact that they are accusing him of hate speech, and they call him a Nazi, which he's not. But anyway, getting beyond all of that, I would suggest people read the article that I wrote about Ken that's on my blog. You can go to truthandshadows.com, and it's the one on the cover, because it's what's really interesting about O'Keefe is, you know, he kind of gets tagged with the whole thing about criticizing, Zionists and Jews and Israelis and the whole thing, and he's sort of known for that, and with good reason. But there's so much more depth to what he has to say, and I think it would really be good for people to get to know more of what he's really all about. I mean, he talks about 9/11. He actually addresses an issue that's come up on this call about the idea that we have to be careful not to get bogged down in accusing each other of things because we have disagreements about different details. And this is something that I've, certainly taken to heart and thought about a lot since I heard him say this. He does, by the way, I just throw this in for fun, but he definitely believes the plane did not hit the Pentagon. But that's only because I asked him a direct question because I was curious. But anyway, he sort of comes at it not so much from the physical evidence side of it, but he talks about Larry Silverstein and Frank Lowy and how their behavior makes no sense whatsoever unless they knew those buildings were coming down. Just the fact that they would acquire the buildings so close to 9/11 and take on this enormous financial liability, since the Port Authority of New York had recently lost a court case trying to absolve themselves of liability for removing the asbestos from the towers. So anyway, this is kind of where he puts the focus. And rather than looking at the thermite and all this sort of stuff. He also has some very fascinating stories to tell about his own activism, his involvement with the peace flotilla that was boarded by Israeli commandos, and nine activists were killed in that, and he personally disarmed one of the Israeli commandos. So he has some very compelling stories to tell about that. He talks about ISIS as being a rebranding of Al-Qaeda and basically the creation of the U.S. and Israel. But I'll conclude with this. The focus of his talk, or the conclusion of his talk, is about what he's trying to do. He has this thing called World Citizenship, World Citizen Solutions. WorldCitizen.Solutions is the website, so you could find a bit more about it. But he basically is talking about a social contract where everybody would agree to three things. One is that, the first being that they affirm their natural rights, the right to travel, the right to self-defense, the right to live. The second one being that they agree to respect the rights of all other human beings. And the third being that they agree to respect the planet. And what this is sort of moving towards, this is the first phase of his plan, but what it's moving towards is the idea that people will be able to refuse to pay into a system that is essentially committing mass murder, that they will be able to refuse to pay taxes, and right, that the system will have a legal defense component in it, so that if you choose to do this on this basis, and on the basis that you sign this contract, that you will not be doing that on your own. You will have a system in place to back you up. So anyway, you can learn a lot more about it than I can just do in a quick time. But anyway, it's a very hopeful and optimistic message in the end. He thinks we're all moving in the right direction. His consciousness is on the rise. So that's kind of a summary of where things went with that. So if anybody wants to ask anything else.
Well, thank you for a very succinct presentation, Craig. Does anybody have a comment or a question on Ken or Keith's visit to Canada?
Question, Barb.
Barb, who else? I'll put myself after Barb. Go ahead, Barb.
Craig, I just like to know, do you know if the whoever the authorities are who are investigating the possibility of a, you know, hate crime, whatever. Did they actually arrest him and interrogate him? I mean, what actually happened with him?
No, he was out of the country by then. He left a few days after his he did two talks in Toronto. So it was the second one that was the one in question. The Jewish Defense League was actually present at the first of the two talks. And you can see video of that online, actually. But the second one was at the University of Toronto, and that's the complaint stems from that talk. The weird thing is that B'nai B'rith says on their website that they filed a complaint with the police, but the police say that they didn't. They say someone else did. So they won't tell me who else did. But I think Ken was already back home in England, where he now lives. He doesn't live in the U.S. anymore. So he wasn't arrested. And I'm my guess is that he won't be, that this will just kind of, because one of the defenses, as I said earlier, if somebody were to be charged with hate crimes, one of the defenses is truth. So you would be able to present evidence that what you're saying is true in a court case. So I'm not sure that the authorities would be excited about having that kind of a trial, but...
That's only in Canada. In Europe, a proof is not accepted. True.
Okay, I'm sorry, we have a stack. Whoever wants
right.
to
yeah, for that.
Give me your name, I'll put you on the stack. Who's that?
Paul Zaremka.
Paul, okay. And who else?
Lynn okay. Bradbury.
Lynn Bradbury, okay. Great. My question, I'm sorry, who else?
Bill,
okay. Craig, my question for you is are the details about his war tax resistance approach on your article on Truth and Shadows?
Are the details about which, I'm sorry?
The war tax resistance proposal that he has?
The contract thing. Yes, it is on there. I mean, it's not a ton of detail. It's at the bottom of the article.
You can go to YouTube, Ken O'Keefe, Become a World Citizen, and find it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so, okay, yeah. Great. Thank you, Barbara. Okay, Paul.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the willfully promoting hate. Is in Canadian law, you could use that against Donald Trump for the birther comments he made about Obama.
Well, but then I'd have to oppose that just in the same way that I would oppose them using it against O'Keefe, because I don't think people should.
I'm just
being facetious.
I'm saying how it could go anywhere. I'm just saying it could go anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so they choose where it goes.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. It's a political crime. Okay, Lynn.
I just wondered if anybody has noticed it, that the state of California is trying to make supporting the BDS movement a crime, and people that do it or corporations that do it will not be able to get state contracts or something like that.
I don't think they're making it a crime, but they are saying that they won't deal with corporations that are that are in support of something
right,
like that.
Right, anyway, trying to crack down on them.
That's the proposal, yeah.
I think they're doing something similar, actually, in Ontario and Canada, interestingly enough, that which is, of course, where this talk was given and where it's now being investigated. But the provincial government there is looking at the same thing.
Barbara.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn. And Barb. I'm not sorry, not Barb. Bill. Bill.
I just wanted to say that I'm looking into the connection between 9/11 and, I guess it's called the Big H, the Holocaust, thinking that if we unravel the threads for the Holocaust, we may unravel the threads for 9/11. And if you've got any connections or have information about it, please send it along to me. And that's it.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks.
Right.
And okay.
Can I say this is Lynn. Can I say one more thing about that? Bill Wilkes posted a video by Mike Pellid about a book that he wrote called "Son, the General's Son," and it's way excellent. Very,
yeah.
Very excellent.
Miko. Yeah,
yeah.
Miko Pellid. Yeah, his father was Israeli general, yeah.
Okay, before we move on to announcements, Robin, are you still on the call?
Yep.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you to consider the fact that you made your comment about Craig and on a talk that was supposed to be about nonviolence, and I'd like to ask you to give serious thought to writing an apology for your comment before the next teleconference, if you give that some thought, okay?
I will give that thought.
Thank you. And now let's move on to our announcements. And I think Craig has a comment that he'd like to make as secretary before we take.
Yes, thanks. Just really quickly, I've noticed that as I do the minutes each month, that the one thing, and this is this, I take the blame for this, but one thing I notice is that very often when it comes to the announcements, that I end up having to listen to the recording, sometimes a few times. To try to figure out the details of everything that people have said, because sometimes people mention things that are where it's kind of thing where everybody knows what it is, but if they don't specifically mention the name of the article, the exact name of the book, or whatever it might be, then I find myself when I'm doing the minutes that I'm having to do research and Google around to try to figure out what article they're talking about. So I guess I just wanted to mention that as we do these, and I'm not going to be shy in sort of jumping in and asking for clarification if I need it, but if people want to make an announcement about an event that happened at a particular place, if you could just pay particular attention to making sure that I have the specific details so that I can just put them in the minutes, because if the thing is too general, it becomes extremely difficult to try to write it up. So.
It's up to anybody that makes an announcement to be extremely clear if you want that announcement to be reposted in the minutes. It's not up to Craig to figure out what you were trying to say. Okay. All right. Thanks. All right. So, does anybody have any announcements for
Paul?
Paul?
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Go ahead, Paul.
I don't know how many of you watched it, but CBS had a program interviewing the 12 living CIA directors on Sunday night, I think it was Sunday night, and at the very end of the presentation, you find out who was the one of the co-directors of the program was nothing other than Jules Naudet, the Naudet brothers.
Oh, boy.
Wow. Wow. CBS
okay,
last
you
Sunday.
Could you clarify one of the directors of what program?
The CBS program, which interviewed all living, including all living CIA directors about 9/11.
Oh.
That was last Sunday.
Oh, about 9/11. Oh, I didn't catch that. For
oh.
So, and that's on, that was 60, on 60 Minutes, you said, Paul?
No, it was a special program on CBS.
Oh, okay.
Not 60 minutes. It was I think it was a 2-hour program. I didn't start at the very beginning. It was two hours.
Is it on YouTube or some link you can send for the minutes?
I don't know. I was watching
live. You're saying CIA directors.
All CIA directors, George Bush on down, the first Bush.
Like, Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We all really.
Jules Naudé was listed as what? As a director?
Of the video of the program of the whole thing. I mean, he was organizing it. I mean, one of the
directors. Oh, I see.
I mean, I don't know what you call that. Yeah, I think it's. I don't know if they call it director or
the producer.
Not probably. Producer. Producer pays for it. It would be the director. I mean, he did it. I mean, he. I mean, and he was interviewed. He was interviewed on CBS morning program. The day before or the day after, he himself, Jules Naudé, was interviewed. I listened to that also. That you might be able to get on YouTube. And, you know, with his French accent and the whole thing.
And when was this program, Paul? Was it last Sunday?
Sunday night. I think it was. Might have been Saturday. CBS. I was called the CIA under the crosshairs or something like that. CIA under the crosshairs or something like that.
Okay.
Over 9/11.
If anybody finds the link, please send it.
It wasn't only about 9/11, but it was certainly a major part of it.
This is Cheryl. Can I jump in here?
Absolutely, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Frank, are you still on the line? Frank Tilupko has done a lot of research on the Naudé brothers and how they aren't really who they say they are. I don't know if you're all aware of that or not. But and then not too long ago, this one got on NPR and was being interviewed about this CIA story that he was doing. And so it's very interesting that he could have access to these people.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think that says a lot.
Exactly. You put two and two together, right?
Right.
Very much.
And wow. Frank has a good
especially,
website.
May I just add, this may explain how President George W. Bush could have possibly actually seen this footage from the Naudé brothers' video so quickly.
I found it online, the actual pointer to it. It was called The Spymaster, CIA in the Crosshairs. It was in, quote, 48 hours, present. How far can the CIA go to keep America safe? All 12 living CIA directors share their passionate disagreements about the agency's past, its current mission, and its future.
Could you send that link or anything you have to the 9/11 telecon list, please?
It's simply www.cbsnews.com/news/48hours. 48 hours, I think.
Yeah, but that'll go to all of the 48 hours. Could you just send it to
well,
the?
Well, this is the recent one, isn't it?
This the last
it was
one.
May,
yeah.
It was May 21.
I'll confirm that, Barbara, and I'll make sure it's the right link in there. I'll get it in there.
Thank you. I think a lot of people would be interested in following up on that.
Would you do us a favor, Craig? That could you send it to the 9/11 telecon list as soon as possible, so we don't have to wait for the minute?
Sure.
I'll send it to you, Barbara, directly.
Also, everybody needs to.
Please send it to everybody.
I believe it's very critical.
I'll send it out to everybody. I'll do that.
Go to the very end where the Naudé brothers are mentioned, okay? Both of them. Jules.
I found it already. It's Spymasters, CIA in the Crosshairs. It says directed by G-E-D-E-O-N Naudé and Jules Naudé.
Yep. Wow. Yep.
There you go. That's the two of them, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that was certainly an interesting announcement. Any other announcements for tonight?
Yeah, Barb, I do.
Barbara? Can you bring us up to date on your campaign? Is there anything of relevance?
Yeah, I can do that. I can get something more important first. And that is, I sent this to everybody in the 28 pages list just a couple hours ago, I think it was, and also on the 9/11 teleconference list, this list. But if you haven't seen it already, you must see a BBC special program, about 24, 25 minutes. You got to listen to the whole thing. I think it's like a YouTube with audio only, but with some inserts of photographs. It's an interview by a BBC moderator who basically takes the side of Saudi Arabia. on JASTA, and the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act bill that passed the Senate unanimously recently and is now with the House of Representatives. And this interview, she interviews, I can't remember their names now, but two women. One is the wife of a man who died in one of the World Trade Center 1, and the other is a survivor, a woman who survived being on the 80th floor and got down the stairwells and to safety miraculously, as well as a retired but on 9/11 active New York City firefighter. And it is the strongest thing that I have seen on the importance of passing the JASTA bill and the atrocity of both the George W. Bush Cheney administration and the Obama administration. Obama saying that he would veto the bill, the JASTA bill. It's unconscionable. And their language is so strong and the emotion comes through so strong that we can use these clips, these audio clips, maybe with the photographs of the individuals, if we can get them for very great benefit. Now, I just want to point out that the moderator, the BBC moderator, not unexpectedly, basically takes the side of Saudi Arabia, and so does another guest on the program who is a female attorney from New Jersey who basically tries to tell these victims, family member, and 9/11 World Trade Center 1 survivor that they really shouldn't be doing this because you don't want to pierce the Saudi sovereign immunity, because then every single survivor of a U.S. drone attack anywhere in the world, or any anti-terrorism, counter-terrorism act, which is the cover story for it, of course, could sue the United States government. And I say amen to that. Amen.
Sure.
So everybody really needs to see this. It won't take much of your time. It's unbelievably powerful. We need to use it and get it out widely so we can post it.
So, Barbara, are you going to send the link to Craig then?
Yeah, well, I sent it to the whole 9/11 telecon a couple of hours ago. I believe Craig's on that.
I'll track that down. Okay.
Yeah, okay. If you don't have it, Craig, let me know. I'm pretty sure you're on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Barb. How's your campaign coming along?
Just briefly. Well, as you know, I'm running for Congress here against Leon Panetta's son in California Congressional District 20 on the Central Coast area of California. And the amazing thing about this race, there's no question on June 7th, which is the primary here in California, that James Panetta, known as Jimmy Panetta, will get the most votes. But what matters is that hopefully I'll be able to knock out the Republican candidate and be number two, in which case I would be on the general election ballot. It's only the top two in the primary. So that's what I'm aiming for. I'm blanketing the radio stations around here, including focusing on our largest radio station south of San Francisco and north of L.A. It's KSCO out of Santa Cruz, known as the People's Republic of Santa Cruz. It's so progressive. And so this radio station, they actually play 2 hours every day of Alex Jones, and I'm going to be targeting all 9/11 truthers there to vote for me in my ad. So I'm going to be doing everything I can, and just want everybody to know I'm really out there on 9/11 Truth big time and in the face of Jimmy Panetta and every single candidate forum. And just so you know, I handed two copies of Behind the Smoke Curtain, the physical DVDs, to Jimmy Panetta and said, hi, Jimmy, one of these is for you and one of them is for your father. So, I'm almost certain that he watched it. And if Jimmy Panetta watched it, he's actually a decent person. Trouble is he's, part of the drone assassination program with his dad. But if he watched it, I'm almost certain that he gave it to Leon Panetta. So, you do everything you can. So I'll give another report next time. Good outreach.
Thank you, Barbara.
Good luck, Barbara. Yeah, that's outreach. This is real outreach.
And the BBC interview was sent at 6:50 p.m., at least Eastern time.
Okay. So you did get it. Good.
I got it.
Okay, great. Any other announcements before we close? Okay, then. Thank you all for your cooperation tonight, almost everybody. And let's start these guests together in June for the next one, the last Wednesday in June.
Oh, we do have an announcement. People need to know that because of a scheduling conflict with Greg, that our debate has been moved to July.
Yeah, it's most likely that the long-awaited debate between Barbara and Craig on the Pentagon will take place in on the July teleconference, hopefully.
Right, so the agenda is open for next month.
Yeah, and the agenda is open for next month. Okay. So, good night, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye.